And then Sarah and I would paddle out here, you know, to the cottage on this little island, to be away from the others. Allie didn't come with us. She had become almost completely nocturnal by then and slept most of the day, storing up energy for her night runs. Nick tagged along, but usually he'd nod off after a picnic out on the dunes. There were beds in the cottage, but he liked to sleep in the rowboat. He enjoyed the rock of the tide and the way the boat knocked against the pylons. There was a little dock then, out alongside the cottage. Oh, that was all right. Sarah and I could have some wine and some fresh air and do what grown-ups like in the cottage. We had a sleepy romp in the sheets one day after a meal of cold chicken and some kind of salad with raisins in it. Just as Sarah was dozing off, she asked me if I would check on Nick. I went out of my bare feet and jeans and saw a little gutter of flame spout up from the boat. I'm sure I would have screamed, only I was too scared to get any air. I staggered out onto the dock, trying to shout Nick's name, as if he could have heard. All that would come out was a thin wheeze. I was sure I'd find him ablaze. But he wasn't on fire. He was breathing fire. Every time the boat knocked against the pylons, he'd cough a mushroom cloud of red flame and then laugh a dozy little giggle. I don't think he was all the way awake or really knew what he was doing. I know he wasn't aware of me watching. After all, he couldn't hear me, and he wasn't looking my way, his entire drowsing attention focused on his work with the flame. By then I had dropped to my knees. My legs had gone all weak. I watched him for 2 or 3 minutes. He'd blow rings of fire, and then wave his fingers and dash off a dart of flame to jump through the hoops. Finally, I was able to get back to my feet, although my knees were still shaking. I made my unsteady way back to the cottage. My tongue was stuck to the roof of my mouth, and I needed a drink of water before I was able to speak. I woke Sarah gently and told her I needed to show her something, and not to be afraid. I said it was about Nick, and that he was all right, but she needed to see what he was doing. And I led her out. When she saw flame spurting from the boat, she got wobbly herself, and I needed to hold her arm to support her. But she didn't shout for him, didn't cry out. She let me lead her to him, trusting me that there was no reason to panic. We stood over him and watched him play with fire for most of 5 minutes, before she was overcome and sank to her knees and reached into the boat to touch him. She stroked her hand over his hair, and he snapped out of the trance he was in, and for a moment was coughing black smoke and blinking blearily. He jumped up on a gunwale, looked embarrassed, as if we had found him flipping through a girly magazine. She climbed into the boat, her whole body trembling, and took him into her arms. I descended after her. For a long time we sat together in silent conference. He told his mother no, he wasn't hurt. It hadn't caused him any pain at all. He told us he had been doing it for days and that it never hurt. He said he always did it in the boat because something about the sway of the ocean helped him get going. He enumerated his many accomplishments. He could breathe smoke, blow streams of fire, and light one hand like a torch. He told us he had made little sparrows of flame and set them flying, and that sometimes it seemed to him he was flying with them. Sometimes it seemed to him he was a sparrow himself. I asked him to show us, and he said he couldn't, not right then. He said after he lit himself on fire, it sometimes took him a while to recharge. He said after throwing sparrows, that was how he described it in sign language, sometimes it was hard to get warm, that he'd have the shivers and feel like he was coming down with flu. I wanted to know how he was doing it. He did his best to explain, but he is only a little boy, and we didn't learn much, not that day. He said you could put the dragon scale to sleep by rocking it gently and singing to it like you'd sing to a baby. Except, of course, Nick is deaf and doesn't have any idea what singing sounds like. He told us that he thought music was like the tide or breath, something that flowed in and back out again in a kind of soothing rhythm. He said he'd get that flow going in his mind, and then the dragon scale would dream whatever he wanted it to dream. It would make rings of fire or sparrows of flame or whatever he liked. I said I didn't understand and asked him if he could show me. He looked at his mother, and Sarah nodded and said it was all right. He could try to teach me how to do it. But if either of us ever hurt ourselves, we had to stop right away. The next morning my lessons began. After 3 days, I could light a candle. In a week I was throwing ropes of fire like a walking flamethrower. I began to show off. I couldn't help myself. When Ellie and I went out on one of our rescue missions, I would make a wall of smoke to create an impressive getaway. And once when we were chased by a cremation crew, I turned on them and ignited, made myself into a great burning demon with wings to scare them off. They ran wailing. How I loved having my own legend, being stared at and whispered about. There is no drug in all the world as addictive as celebrity. I boasted to Sarah that getting Dragon Scale was the best thing that had ever happened to me. That if someone came up with a cure, I'd refuse to take it. That the scale wasn't a plague, it was evolution. We often discussed my ideas about Dragon Scale. How it was transmitted, how it bonded with the mind, how it produced enzymes to protect Nick and me from burns. I say we discussed my ideas. What I really mean is I lectured her, and she listened. Oh, I did like having an audience for all my insights and theories. That's what should be on her death certificate, you know. Sarah Story, Talked to Death by John Rookwood. In a sense, that's what happened to her. I remember the day after I first turned into a devil and scared off a crowd of armed men. I took Sarah out to the island for a picnic and a celebratory screw. She was quiet, off in her own head, but I was too full of my own greatness to really notice. We made love, and after I lay in bed, feeling like a rock star at last. She got up and found her jeans and dug a bottle out of a pocket, a bottle full of white grime. I asked her what she had there. She said it was infected ash. Then, in front of me, she dumped it on the kitchen counter and snorted it. She poisoned herself intentionally. She did it before I had time to scream. She knew all about how to infect herself, of course, because I had told her just how the spore spread. 3 days later, the first marks appeared across her back. It looked as if the devil had lashed her with a burning whip. I was right about the method of transmission, but for once there wasn't any pleasure in saying, I knew it. She was dead less than 4 weeks later. 15. He grimaced, holding his right wrist in his left hand. How's your pain? She asked. It's not as hard to talk about as I thought. It feels good to remember her, even the bad stuff at the end. Sometimes I think I've spent the last 9 months lighting fires because it feels so good to burn things down. Like, if Sarah burned, then so can the rest of the world. Arson is almost as good as Prozac. He went silent, thinking. Shit. You weren't asking about psychological pain, were you? Yeah, I was asking about your wrist. Oh, quite hurty, actually. Is that normal? After popping the bones of the wrist out of place for a second time? Yes. He twined the fingers of his good hand through hers. He stared across the room at the furnace, the hatch open on a square of yellow leaping flame. I hate a little that this feels good, he said. We're just holding each other. We're not even undressed. I shouldn't have kissed you outside. We were drunk. We were having fun. I'm still in love with her, Harper. That's okay, John. This isn't anything. It is, though. It's something to me. Okay. It's something to me, too. But we aren't going to do anything you have to feel bad about. You haven't been held since she died, and people need that. People need closeness. Firewood whistled and snapped. But she isn't dead. She isn't alive, but she isn't dead either. She's stuck. I know. The fireman turned his head to look back at her, his gaunt features drawn in alarm and surprise. I've known for a while, Harper said. I saw her once, in the fire. I know there's something there, anyway, something in the furnace that you're keeping alive. But whatever that is, it can't be a person. It can't be aware. Flame can't have a consciousness. The spore can. That's how the phoenix seems alive. It is. It's a part of me, like a hand. Sarah's body burned, but the girl in the fire remains. As long as I keep the fire going, some incombustible part of her survives. You should sleep. I don't think I can. Not with my wrist throbbing like it is. Besides, maybe I don't just need to tell. Maybe you need to hear. Before you go any further down the road you're on and wind up killing yourself like she did. 16. She took to the bright straight off. I've never seen anyone get it faster. 4 days after she developed visible marks, she was lighting up with us in chapel, brimming with brightness and joy. You know how the scale can be peculiarly beautiful? Comparing Sarah to the others was like comparing lightning to the lightning bug. It was exciting and a little scary. She had more power than any of us. She'd play the organ, and after, no one could remember their own name. They could only remember hers. For hours after we joined together in the bright, people would drift around, talking like her, walking like her. Carol has that effect on people now. Harper considered for a moment, then said, Allie does too, I think, to a lesser degree. Sarah wanted me to show her how to light herself up, how to cast flame. She wanted to know how to send her consciousness out into fire. By then I was incorporating the Phoenix into rescue attempts, and Nick was making flocks of burning sparrows to hunt for the infected. I wouldn't teach her, though. I was angry. I was so angry. Angry and scared. It was one thing to be contaminated by accident, and another to contaminate yourself on purpose. She wouldn't let me off the hook, either. She threw every boast, every know-it-all lecture, every smug certainty back in my face. If casting fire was safe for her deaf 9-year-old and safe for her lover, it was safe for her. I had told her I wouldn't trade the scale for anything, that I was glad to be a carrier. Didn't we all say, in chapel every day, how lucky we were, how blessed? She had seen us reeling with pleasure, with delight. How could I want that for myself and deny it to her? She had seen me fight for the sick and wanted to fight by my side. How could I refuse her? The more she talked, the more pig-headed I became. I hated her, myself, the world. I was ill with it, sick with malice. There was so much I didn't know. Only two people could throw fire without hurting themselves, Nick and myself. I held back on trying to teach Allie, although she had nagged me often enough. I had sound reasons for reluctance. Consider this, for example. What if full mastery of the dragon scale is only possible for those with a Y chromosome? I'm sure that sounds sexist, but nature has never had any great interest in gender equality. What if you need a certain blood type to make it work? What if it's a quirk of DNA? Like those who are immune to HIV because of a mutation that strips them of the receptor the virus needs to infect them. So I wouldn't teach Sarah. In the last weeks, I was hardly talking to her. We shouted, we screamed at each other, but that wasn't what I would call talking. I thought if I didn't teach her, at least she wouldn't be any worse off than anyone else in camp. At least she would be kept safe by joining the Bright. I thought I could protect her by shutting her out, putting a wall up between us. If Harper listened very intently, she could hear the coals whistling softly in the furnace. So she turned to Nick, she said. Yes, he replied in a listless tone. Nick told me later that she very quickly learned to light candles with her fingertips, which was how I started. He said he thought if she could do that much, it meant it would be okay to teach her more. But he also said the first time she lit a candle, she yelped like it burned, although she told him she only cried out because she was startled. Later he noticed she would always keep a glass of cold water on hand, and after lighting candles would grip it tightly, as if her fingertips were sore. Sometimes she even dipped her fingers into it. All this was done without my knowledge. They practiced at night, out in the cottage, when I was off with Allie, rescuing the sick and polishing my personal legend. Sarah wanted to learn how to push her consciousness into puppets of flame, as I did with the Phoenix and Nick did with his flocks of flaming sparrows. Nick thought that was like skipping basic addition and going right to fractions. He wanted her to try making her hand into a torch first, or practice throwing balls of flame. But she teased and kidded and gamed him into it. Nick never had a chance. So he explained the general principles, just the basic ideas. He didn't think she'd really... He assumed she was just curious, and he fell silent again, staring at the furnace, its orange glow shifting over his features like a gentle touch. I was just back from one of my expeditions with Allie. We had returned to camp with a few refugees, poor Nelson Heinrich among them, I believe. I was already on my way out to the island when I saw the smoke coming from the cottage. It was all over long before anyone in camp realized what was happening. I paddled to the dock at the southern end of the island, the dock that isn't there anymore. As I pulled myself onto the planks, the roof of the cottage fell in. I flung myself in through the back door, and a moment later the chimney collapsed on the dock behind me, crushed most of it into the water. The whole first floor had old, exposed beams. One of them had dropped onto Nick. He was unconscious, but I could see him breathing. Heat billowed, distorting the air. Everything was smoke and sparks. I saw him, and I saw her. What was left of her? Bones and ash and... He swallowed, shook his head, pushed the memory aside. I am sure if Nick wasn't there, I would have dropped. I was hysterical, in shock. But he was there, and I needed to get him out. I tried to lift the beam, but I couldn't. It had to weigh near on 400 pounds. I strained against it, not budging it, screaming at God, screaming at Sarah, just screaming. Then she was there with me, on the other side of the beam, beside her son. The fireman spoke now in a hush, staring into the furnace with what was either awe or dread. I shuddered to see her, in the middle of all that blazing heat. I shuddered like someone in a freezing rain. She was so lovely. She was the most lovely thing. She was walking flame, as blue as a blowtorch, her hair flowing ribbons of red and gold fire. She made a hatchet out of thin air, a hatchet of fire, you understand, and swept it through one end of the beam, snapped it in two in one stroke. That hatchet was so hot, it would have sliced through the beam even if it had been an iron girder. I tossed the big piece of lumber off Nick and got the hell out of there with him. I only looked back once, at the door. She was still standing there, watching me go with him. She knew me. I could see recognition in her features. Her face was beautiful and sad, confused. I knew she was self-aware. She had been a woman one moment. In the next, she was an elemental of fire. The house fell in on itself. The fire burned low. I never left the island. I sat in the dunes and watched. People came to me to offer food or comfort. I paid them no mind. Allie sat with me for hours. The sun rose up hot and dry and baked the island beneath it, and I didn't move. The house was still burning when the sun set again, although by then it was mostly smoldering coals. I dozed off for a while. When I woke, she was standing in what remained of the ruin, a ghost of pale golden flame. She vanished again almost as soon as I saw her, but by then I knew for sure. What remained of her consciousness was threaded in the coals, spread across a billion microscopic particles of dragon scale that wouldn't and couldn't be destroyed. She was ash and flame. I have been on the island ever since, and I have never let that first fire burn out. It's still going in the furnace. She's still there. She's still with me. I believe her consciousness is held in place by the energy produced by the fire, and will only break apart if the flames die for good. And I suppose that's all of it. Few people in camp have any idea what Nick can do. He doesn't cast flame anymore. You can understand why. He holds himself responsible for the death of his mother. Can you imagine being 9 years old and having that thought in your head? He doesn't know she's still with us, and I haven't dared show him. I'm scared of what it would do to him. What if he thinks she's suffering, and it's his fault? He shifted about uncomfortably, and his gaze drifted from the furnace to the door. He stiffened. My God, you've been here for hours. You have to get back to the infirmary before sunrise. You've already stayed too long. A minute more, she told him. Michael promised he could cover for me all night if he had to. He rolled halfway over to look into her face. You have to take care of yourself, Arbor. There's a boy who loves you very much. You're the one thing that keeps him going. It took her a moment to realize he was talking about Nick, not himself. He's still got all that guilt on him. He's trapped under it, as badly as he was ever trapped under the beam. Look who's talking, she said. For a moment he couldn't meet her gaze. You see why I don't want you doing anything ever again, like what you did with the arrow. I've already lost one woman I care about. You don't get to burn yourself up like her, Nurse Willows. I can't lose you, too. She held him a moment longer, then kissed his whiskery cheek and climbed from the bed. She arranged his sheets over him, tucked him in. Harper stood over him, looking down into his lean, tired face. She said, What happened to Sarah Story isn't your fault, you know, or Nick's. Neither of you have any right to blame yourself for her death. Harold Cross could have explained why. I love you, John Rookwood. She had never said this to him before, but she said it now, firmly and calmly, and continued without giving him a chance to reply. But you are not a doctor, and you do not understand the nature of this infection. Sarah Story didn't die because Nick taught her badly. She didn't die because she lacks a Y chromosome, or because she was missing some necessary mutation, or any other random reason you can think of. In between his horrible poetry and stomach-turning misogyny, Harold filled a notebook with solid research. The spore only penetrates the human brain very slowly. It takes about 6 weeks to reach Broca's region, the area that processes communication, even in the deaf. You said she had only been infected for, what, 2 weeks, three? She rushed it. That simple. He gazed at her in bewilderment. You can't know that. Not for sure. But I do, John. You have every right to grieve, but I'm afraid your guilt is undeserved. So are your fears about my safety. I've been covered in dragon scale for almost 9 months. It's in every cell of my body. There is nothing you know how to do that I can't learn. You should have talked to Harold. The fireman let out a long, sighing breath and all at once seemed smaller, hollowed out. I didn't have much to do with Harold in the last weeks before the poor boy died. He was grotesque to Allie, and I was out here on the island in mourning. I hardly saw him. Actively avoided him, in fact. What are you talking about? You're the one who snuck him out of the infirmary. He said so in his journal. The fireman shot her a surprised, wondering look. Either you're mistaken, or he was keeping a diary of daydreams. In which case, I'm not sure we ought to place much confidence in his medical information either. I didn't slip him out of the infirmary. Not once. You can't imagine what an odious little troll he was. Harper gazed at him blankly, feeling wrong-footed and mixed up. She had looked through the diary plenty of times, and was sure Harold had said John Rookwood had been his one ally in the last days. Enough of this, he said and nodded at the door. You have to go. Keep your head down and hurry right back to the infirmary. We'll figure it out later. There will be another night for this. But there never was. 17. Harper returned in darkness, the air curiously warm and aromatic with the smell of pines and rich black loam. When she ducked into the infirmary, there was a thin line of milk-colored light drawing a pale gleam along the far eastern edge of the Atlantic. She found Michael stretched on the couch in the waiting room, with a Ranger Rick spread across his chest and his eyes closed. When she shut the door, he stirred, stretched, rubbed at his soft boy's face. Any trouble? Harper asked him. Bad, he said, and lifted the Ranger Rick. I'm stuck halfway through the word find, which is pretty pathetic when you think this is for kids. He showed her a big, sleepy, innocent smile and said, Way I heard it, the prisoners got back fine, and no one the wiser. I guess Chuck Cargo was pretty huffy about spending an hour shut into the meat locker. He told him he'd take scalps if any of them said anything about it to Ben Patchett and got him in trouble. One of these nights, Michael, I'd like to set up a transfusion and run some of your blood into me. I could use some of your courage. I'm just glad you got a couple hours with your guy. If anyone in this camp deserves one night of TLC, it's you. Harper wanted to tell him that the fireman wasn't exactly her guy, but found when she tried to reply that her throat was choked up, and there was an uncomfortable burning in her face that had nothing to do with dragon scale. A different sort of boy might have laughed at her embarrassment, but Michael only politely redirected his gaze to his word find. My two sisters would have finished this thing hours ago, and they weren't either of them 10 years old. I guess I'll get it tomorrow. I arranged with Ben to watch the infirmary all week, in case you needed more time to work things out with Mr. Rookwood, or to pass messages to the others, or whatnot. I could kiss you on the mouth, Michael. Michael turned scarlet, all the way back to his ears, and Harper laughed. She thought she would find Nick asleep when she came in, and she did. But he wasn't in his bed, or in hers. He was stretched out alongside his grandfather. Nick's arm was across Tom's Dory's chest, his pudgy hand resting over Tom's heart. That chest rose, caught in place for an unnerving length of time, and then sank in a slow, weary cycle that made Harper think of a rusting oil derrick that is about ready to grind to a halt. A pale slash of dawn fell across Nick's cheek, bringing out the pink, healthy warmth in his impossibly flawless complexion. It touched some curls of his tousled black hair and turned their tips to brass and copper. She could not help herself. When she came around the side of the bed to check Father Story's IV, she reached out and lightly mussed Nick's hair, delighting in the boy's silk of it. He slowly opened his eyes and yawned enormously. "Sorry," she said with her hands. "Back to sleep." He ignored her and replied in sign. He was awake again. "How long?" "Just a few minutes. He said my name. With his mouth, not with sign language, but I could tell."
"Did he say anything else?"
Nick's face clouded over. "He asked where my mom was. He didn't remember that part, that she died. I couldn't tell him. I said I didn't know where she was." He turned his face away, stared out the window into the blood glow of morning light. The dragon scale could rework the biology of a person's lungs so he could breathe even in suffocating smoke. But it couldn't do anything about your shame. Couldn't make you breathe any easier when you had a 400-pound beam of guilt across your chest. She wanted to tell him that he didn't get anyone killed. That blaming himself for what happened to his mother was as silly as blaming gravity when someone stepped out of a window and fell 10 stories. Nor was there any sense in blaming his mother. When Sarah Story stepped out the window, she had honestly believed with all her heart she could fly. Death by plague was, after all, not a punishment for moral failings. Men and women were firewood, and in a time of contagion the righteous and the wicked were fed to the blaze in turn, without any discernment between them. "Some will come back to him," Harper said to Nick.
"And some of it won't?"
"Some won't."
"Like who tried to kill him?"
"Give time," she told him. "With time, he may remember Big Lot." Nick frowned, then said,
"He told me he wants to talk to you. He said he just needs a little more sleep."
Harper grinned.
"Did he say how much more?"
"Just till tonight."
"Is that what he said?" Harper asked.
Nick nodded solemnly.
"Okay," Harper said. "But try no be disappointed if he no wake tonight. This will be long, slow, get well time."
"He'll be ready," Nick said.
"What about you?"
18. In an unexpected turn of events, Father Story, completely recovered and wearing an immaculate surplice, told Harper to go unto the old school bus at the gates of Camp Wyndham and keep a watch on the road. He even used the word unto, like someone quoting verse from the Bible. He issued this command from a throne of bleak white rock at the center of the memorial circle, while his flock emerged from the vast red doors of the chapel behind him. The people of Camp Wyndham were in gay spirits, laughing and chattering animatedly, while some of the children sang, "Burning Down the House," in their high, piping voices. Harper was troubled to observe some of the adults lugging big red cans of gasoline.
"What's going on?"
"It was foretold we should have a cookout," he informed her. "For we expect friends to come upon us tonight," bearing happy tidings. I say unto you, arise and go along the road and keep your watch. We will prepare the cook fire and roast s'mores in the name of the bright. He winked at her. Don't take too long and I'll save you one. She wanted to ask who had done all the foretelling, but time skipped before she could find out, and then she was walking along the road, beneath a dark and starless sky. In the distance, she could hear the congregation roaring the talking heads, bellowing about the sweet release of burning it all down. She hurried. She didn't want to miss s'mores. She wondered who had brought them chocolate and marshmallows. Probably the same person who had been foretelling things. She was in such a hurry, she almost stumbled over the man in the road. She took a wild lurch into high, wet grass to avoid stepping on him. She had not yet reached the bus, which was further down the hill. Nelson Heinrich lifted his head and looked up at her. She knew it was Nelson by his ugly Christmas sweater, even though half his face had been flayed off to show the red bunching muscles beneath. His foggy, good-humored eyes peered out from that glistening crimson mask. He looked almost exactly like the anatomical bust that had once been on the counter in the infirmary. "I told you I'd get here," Nelson said. "I hope there are enough s'mores for everyone. I brought friends." The freightliner rumbled at the bottom of the hill, filthy smoke coming unstrung from the exhaust pipe behind the cab. Nelson pulled himself another half a foot, arm over arm. His guts, long ropes of intestine, dragged in the dirt behind him. "Come on, guys," he shouted. "I told you I could show you where to find them. Let's go get something sweet. A spoonful of sugar for everyone." Harper fled. She didn't flee as well as she used to. At 8 months pregnant, she ran with all the agility and grace of a woman carrying a large stuffed chair. But she was still faster than Nelson, and the freightliner wasn't moving just yet, and she crested the hill ahead of both of them and came into the light of the great fire. An enormous bonfire blazed, a mountain of coals as big as a cottage, great tongues of flame lapping at the overcast night. Instead of stars, the night was filled with whirling constellations of dying sparks. Harper opened her mouth to scream, but there was no one to hear. No one standing around the fire with marshmallows on sticks. No knots of adults drinking cider. No children chasing one another and singing. They had not gathered to enjoy the fire. They were the fire. It was a great sagging hill of black corpses, flames squirting through the eye sockets of charred skulls, the heat whistling through baked rib cages. The fire made a quite cheerful sound, knots popping, bodies seething. Nick sat on the very top of the bonfire. She could tell it was Nick, because even though he was a cooked and withered corpse, he was staring back at her with his burning eyes, gesturing frantically with his hands. "Behind you! Behind you! Behind you!" She whirled, just as Jacob pulled the air horn of the freightliner in a shrill, heart-rending blast. The truck idled, headlights off, 20 feet away, her ex-husband no more than a dark figure behind the steering wheel. "Here I am, darling," he shouted. "You and me, babe. How about it?" And there was a great crash as he threw the big orange truck into gear, and the headlights snapped on. So much light. So much. 19. Light shining into her face. She blinked and sat up, one hand lifted to shield her eyes from the glare. Bile stewed in her throat. She peered past the beam of the flashlight. Nick stood behind it, his eyes wide in his small, handsome face, his hair a delightful mess. He lifted one finger to his mouth, "Shh," and then pointed to Father Story, whose eyes were open and who was smiling at her, showing her his old, soft, kindly Dumbledore smile. His gaze was perfectly clear and alert. Harper sat up and turned to face him, hanging her legs off the side of her cot. A candle guttered in a shallow dish at his bedside. In a quiet, fragile voice, Father Story said, "From time to time, my friend John Rookwood has teased me by saying the study of theology is as pointless as a hole in the head. I understand from Nick You saved my life with a quarter-inch drill bit through the back of my skull. I think that puts me one up on John. We'll have to let him know.
His eyes glittered.
He also liked to tell me that religious people are closed-minded. Who has the open mind now, eh?
Do you remember who I am, Father? She said to him.
I do. The nurse.
I'm quite confident we were friends, although I'm afraid I'm having trouble recalling your name just now. You cut your hair, and I think that's throwing me off.
Is it Juliet Andrews? No, that's wrong.
Harper, she said.
Ah, he said. Yes, Harper.
He frowned.
Harper Gallows?
Close. Willows. She touched his wrist, took his pulse. It was strong, steady, slow. How's your head?
Not as bad as my left foot, he said.
What's wrong with your left foot?
It feels ant-bit.
She went to the end of his cot and looked at the foot. In between the big toe and the second toe was an infected lump, where it did indeed look like he might have been bitten by a spider. There were other, older red marks where he had been bitten other times, and all of it was encircled by a yellowing bruise.
Hmm, she said. Something got you.
Sorry about that. I was probably preoccupied with looking after that hole in your coconut. You suffered a serious subdural hematoma. You nearly died.
How long have I been out? He asked.
A little over 2 months. You've been in and out of consciousness the last few days. After your head injury, there were serious complications. You suffered at least 2 seizures, several weeks apart. At one time, I doubted you'd recover.
Strokes?
She sat on the edge of his bed. In sign language, she asked Nick to get her heart-ear-listen-to-him thing, and he went to the counter to find her stethoscope.
Are you talking to my grandson in sign language? Father Story asked.
Nick is a good teacher. He smiled at that. Then his brow furrowed in thought.
If I had a stroke, how come my speech isn't slurred?
That doesn't always happen. Likewise, partial paralysis. But you have feeling in both hands, your feet? Your face isn't numb? He stroked his beard, pinched his nose.
No.
That's good, she said in a slow voice, thinking it over. Seeing in her mind the swollen red spider bite between his toes, then dismissing it. Nick brought her the stethoscope. She listened to Father Story's heart, strong, and lungs, clear. She tested his vision, asking him to follow the head of a Q-tip with his gaze, moving it in toward his nose and then out.
Will I slip back into coma? He asked.
I don't think so.
Where did the IV come from? He asked, looking over at it.
That's a long story. A lot has changed in the last few months. His eyes brightened with excitement.
Is there a cure? For the scale?
No, she said.
No. No, of course not. Or we wouldn't still be hiding at Camp Wyndham, and you wouldn't be treating me in the infirmary.
He studied her face, and his smile became something sad and worried.
Carol, what has she done?
Let's keep the focus on you for now. Would you like to try a sip of water?
I would. I would also like to have my question answered. I believe I could manage both at the same time.
She did not ask Nick to get the water, but went and poured some herself. Wanted the time to think. When she came back to the bed, she held the cup and waited while Father Story struggled to get his head off the pillow to take a sip. When he was done, he slumped back and smacked his lips. I think it would be best for Carol to speak to you herself, Harper said. She'll be relieved to know you're awake. She's been at her wit's end without you. Although she's had the support of Ben Patchett and his team of lookouts, and that's meant a lot. They've kept things going, anyway. She thought that was a politic way to put it. Father Story wasn't smiling anymore. His complexion was pale and sickly, and he was starting to sweat.
No, I better see John first, Miss Willows. Before my daughter is notified I'm awake. Can you bring him to me? There are matters that won't wait.
He paused, and then his gaze met hers.
What was done with the person who attacked me?
We don't know who attacked you. Some think it was one of the prisoners, a man named Mark Mazzucchelli. But he insists that you split up in the woods, and when he left you, you were fine. I raise the possibility you might have been assaulted by the camp's thief, who wanted to shut you up before you could expose them over a few cans of Spam, Father Story asked. Anyway, what do I know about the thief?
You told me you knew who it was.
Did I?
I don't think I did.
Although I suppose I might have and forgot. There are several things I don't recall, including who decided to thump me in the head.
He pursed his lips and his brow furrowed, and then he shook his head.
No, I don't think I ever figured out who the thief was.
You told me in the canoe that someone would have to leave camp.
Do you remember that conversation? Harper asked. The night we rode to South Mill Pond together?
Not really, Father Story said. But I'm sure I wasn't talking about the thief.
Who do you think we were talking about then? Harper asked.
I imagine we were discussing my daughter, Father Story said, as if it should be obvious. Carol. She called a cremation crew on Harold Cross. She set him up, arranged the whole thing, so when Ben Patchett shot the poor boy, it would look like he had to protect the camp and keep Harold from giving information to our enemies.
20. Harper had a sidelong look at Nick. He had settled on the foot of her cot, hands folded together under his chin, to watch his grandfather. His face was a serene blank. The room was very dark, with only the low flame of that single candle to cast any light, and she had no sense Nick had any idea what Father Story had just told her. She reminded herself that he wasn't much of a lip-reader, even in the best light.
"How do you know this?" Harper asked.
"Carol told me so herself. You will recall, the last time I spoke to the congregation, I discussed the need to find it in our hearts to forgive the thief. Later, when we were alone, Carol and I fought over that. She said I was weak and that people in camp would abandon us if we didn't show strength. She told me I should have made an example out of Harold Cross. I remarked that a very terrible example had been made out of Harold Cross, one I was sure pleased her. I was being nasty and exaggerating, but she got confused and said in a flat voice, 'So you know.' I felt all icy through my chest and said, 'What do you mean?' And she said, 'That I used him to set an example.' Of course, I only meant that Harold had disobeyed and got himself killed. But Carol misunderstood me and thought I was confronting her over what she had done. She said it was just as well she called a cremation crew on him. If she hadn't done it, Harold would have been discovered eventually anyway, only there might not have been anyone close to keep him from being captured alive. She said she wasn't ashamed of herself. She had saved me and my grandchildren and the entire camp. She was flushed and looked triumphal. I said I didn't believe Ben Patchett would be part of such a scheme, and she laughed as if I had made a very good joke. She said I had no idea how hard it was to carry on the pretense that everyone was as good and kind as I hoped they'd be, to perpetuate my childish fantasies of everyday decency and abundant forgiveness. I didn't know what to say. I couldn't think. She said in a lot of ways I was as responsible for Harold's death as her, that I had forced us all into a position where he had to be shot. She told me if there had been more severe punishments right at the beginning, if, for example, we'd kept him in leg irons or taken a birch to him in public, he wouldn't have continued to put everyone at risk by sneaking out of camp. Well, before I could come up with a response, Ben Patchett was hammering at the door, saying it was time to go. Honestly, I didn't dare try to answer her arguments, not with Ben and Carol both there. I know my daughter wouldn't hurt me, but I wasn't sure what Ben might.
How sure? Harper asked. If she was rattled, if she thought she might be exiled, don't you think she could have been the one who clubbed you in the head?
Not for an instant. My daughter would never, ever try to have me killed. I am as sure of that as I am of my own name. No, I abjure the notion entirely. Tell me, while I was unconscious,
Did she seem in any way ambivalent about my recovery?
Harper inhaled deeply, remembering.
No. In fact, she threatened to have me driven from the camp and my baby taken from me if you died.
Father Story blanched.
She has been hysterical at the thought you might die, Harper added, and then gave her head a little shake. She was remembering what the fireman had told her, that Carol had always been desperate to have her father all to herself, that he was, in a sense, the one true passion in her life. Love could turn to murder, of course. Harper understood that better than most, perhaps. But somehow, no, it didn't feel right. Not really. Carol might set a death warrant upon Harold Cross, but not her father. Never her father. Father Story seemed to see this exact conclusion in Harper's frowning expression.
You mustn't imagine Carol felt I represented any kind of threat to her. Nor was she ashamed of what she had done. She was proud. She sensed, of course, that if the entire camp knew, it might crack us all apart, that there was a need for secrecy, but not a need for shame. No, I can't believe my own daughter would conclude she needed to kill me to preserve my silence. It is impossible to imagine. I am sure she hoped I would come around to her way of thinking with time, except that a little murder was necessary to protect the camp. At the very least, she hoped I would continue to be the loving, decent, charitable face of our nightly chapel services, and leave her to see to the dirty details of looking after the community. Those were her exact words.
It maddened Harper that she couldn't put together what had happened to Father Story in the woods. She felt it was all right there, everything she needed to know, but it was like meeting an acquaintance and not being able to remember their name. No matter how she strained, she couldn't see it. So leave it, she thought. Didn't matter. She didn't need to figure it out. Not right now.
Bring John, Father Story said gently. Then we'll talk with Carol, and Allie, and Nick. I'd like my family around me now. If there are difficult things to say, we'll get through them together. That's what we've done in the past, and it hasn't failed us yet.
He narrowed his eyes.
Do you think people will understand what Carol did to Mr. Cross? Do you think they'll forgive her?
Harper wondered how many people would forgive Father Story for exposing her, but didn't say so. He saw her doubts in her face anyway.
You think it will be the end of our camp, he said.
After a moment she replied, not with an answer, but with a question of her own. Do you remember all the talk about Martha Quinn's island?
Yes.
It's real. We know where it is. I'd like to go there. There's a medical facility where I can safely deliver my baby. I know some others would like to go as well. I think, after it gets around about Harold Cross, and that you've recovered, I think, yes, camp might break up. The night you were attacked, you told me someone was going to have to be exiled from camp, sent away for good. I didn't know you meant Carol. I suppose... She drew a deep, steadying lungful of air. She was about to suggest an idea she found perfectly loathsome.
She could come with me.
With us.
Those who will leave, if we're allowed to go.
Of course you would be allowed to go, he said. And perhaps it might be better to keep Carol here after all. In some form of confinement. I would stay behind as well, to look after her. To help her back to her best self, if at all possible.
Father, Harper said.
Tom.
Tom, maybe we should wait for another day to talk to your daughter. You're very weak right now. I think you should rest.
He said, I'll rest better when I've seen my granddaughter and John. And yes, my daughter. I love Carol very dearly. I understand if you can't, if you hate her. But know at least that whatever she's guilty of, whatever her crimes... She always believed she was doing it in the name of caring for the people she loves.
Harper thought Carol had a sick need to make others conform, to yield, that had nothing to do with love at all. But Tom Story could no more see that in his daughter than Nick could hear. She didn't bother to say so, though. If Tom really meant to deal with her tonight, there was plenty of unpleasantness to come, and she didn't care to add to it. So, John first. Send word for Allie. Allie would bring Carol. Whatever Father Story had to face, he wouldn't face it alone. She turned to Nick and spoke with her hands. I am going to get the fireman. Keep Papa company. He needs you. He can have sips of water, small, not many. Do you see? Is my words right? Nick nodded, and his hands replied, I got it. Go on. Harper began to move. She was glad to move, wanted her body to catch up to the speed of her thoughts. She ducked through the moss-colored curtain. Michael was on watch, as he had promised he would be. He had set his Ranger Rick aside for once and had his .22 rifle across his knees, was rubbing some oil or polish into the butt with a rag. Michael, she said. Yes'm? He's awake. Father's Story. Michael jumped up, grabbing his rifle to keep it from falling on the floor. You're pulling my leg. No way! She had to smile. Couldn't help it. The simple surprise in his face, the wide-eyed innocence, made him look more of a boy than ever. His guileless expression brought to mind her 4-year-old nephew, although in truth they looked nothing alike. He is. He's awake and he's talking. Does he? Michael's Adam's apple jogged up and down in his throat. Does he remember who attacked him? No, but I think it'll come back to him soon enough. He's much keener than I would have expected or hoped for. Listen, he wants me to get John. When John's here, he wants us to bring Carol. And Allie, of course. He wants his whole family around him. And I want you there, too. Well, I don't know that I have any place, he faltered. This might be a difficult reunion. I'd like you there in case people get carried away by their emotions. You think they might fight about the things Mother Carol has been up to? He asked. You don't have any idea, Michael. It's not what she's done while Father Story's been unconscious. It's what she did before he got his head bashed in. If people knew, she never would have been put in charge of anything, her or Ben Patchett either. She thought of Ben Patchett pumping a bullet into Harold Cross, and all at once could taste the sweet, acrid flavor of bile in the back of her throat. Fucking Ben Patchett, she said. Michael frowned. I don't think Mr. Patchett is too bad a guy. Maybe he got a little carried away once when those outlaws got dragged into camp. But I can kind of understand. He's a criminal, Harper said. He shot a defenseless boy. Harold Cross? Oh, Miss Willows, he had to do that. Did he? Did he really? There was such innocence and wonder and bafflement in Michael's expression. She couldn't help herself. Had to lean forward and kiss his freckled brow. His shoulders jumped in surprise. You remind me of my nephew, she said. Little Connor Willows. Connor Jr. I'm not sure why. You both have kind eyes, I guess. Do you think you can be brave a while longer, Michael? Can you do that for me? He swallowed. I hope so. Good. Don't let anyone in to see him until I get back. I'm trusting you to look after him. Michael nodded. He was very pale behind his copper beard. I know what I have to do. Don't you worry, ma'am. I'll take care of Father's Story. 21. She wanted to run, but there was no way. Her stomach, heavy with baby, had assumed a firmness and size that was magnificent, planetary. So she zigged and zagged through the mazy pines in a shambling jog, sweating and breathing hard. In the dark, with her pulse thumping behind her eyes, it was doubtful she would have seen Michael Lindquist following at a distance, even if she had looked for him. He went with care, in no hurry, watching for a long time before he moved from one tree to the next. If she had seen him, she might have been surprised by his expression, his small, tight mouth and narrowed eyes. There was nothing particularly childlike about it at all. He followed her as far as the boathouse, but when she went on toward the dock, he went in, and had soon disappeared among the shadows. Harper took her time making it down the wooden steps cut into the sandy embankment, grabbing bunches of seagrass to steady her. The ocean was a metal plate dented all over as if it had been battered by 1,000 hammer blows. Moonlight blinked silver on the edges of the waves. Looked a little choppy out there. Harper didn't see the man sitting on the end of the dock until she was out on it, halfway to the rowboat.
Don Lewiston jerked his head around to look back over his shoulder. He sat with a steel pail on his right and a fishing pole across his knees.
"Nurse Willows, what brings you bounding down the hill?" he asked.
He wasn't fishing alone. Chuck Cargill stood on the pebbly beach, holding a rod of his own, his rifle behind his feet on the rocks. Cargill squinted doubtfully up at them.
"Father Story is awake. Can you get away? He wants to see John just as soon as possible."
Don's tangled eyebrows shot up, and his mouth opened in an almost comic gape.
"Yar, I think..."
He stood, cupped one hand around his mouth.
"Chucky boy, hold the fort here. I gotta row the missus out to see John. She wants to have a look-see at that busted wing of his." "Mr. Lewiston, Mr. Lewiston, I don't think..."
A tug on his line distracted him. The end of his rod bent toward the water. He gave it an irritated glance, then returned his gaze to Harper and Don Lewiston.
"Mr. Lewiston, you better wait before you go anywhere. I should clear it with Mother Carol first."
Don tossed his rod aside, took Harper's arm, and began to help her down into the rowboat.
"It's already cleared, or Mama Carol never would have let the nurse even come down here. Now I ain't gonna let a lady fackin' 8 months pregnant try to row herself out there alone in this chop. Mr. Lewiston, you gotta hang on,"
Cargill said, taking a step toward them, but still holding his rod, which was now curved in a long parabolic arc, the line straining at the end of it.
"You gotta hit, Chucky," Don cried, stepping into the rowboat himself. "Don't you dare lose this one. That's Ben Patchett's supper you got on your line. I'll be back by the time you reel her in."
Don bent to the oars, and the boat took a herky-jerky jump away from the dock. As he swept them out across the water, leaning all the way forward and then pitching himself all the way back, the oars banging in their iron rings and plunging into the water, Harper told him what she knew. When she got to the part about Carol setting Harold up, Don made a face like a man who has caught a whiff of something corrupt. Which was more or less the case, she supposed.
"And Ben Patchett was a triggerman for her?"
"It seems." He shook his head.
"What?" "I can just about believe Ben would shoot the nasty little fat boy for her. Ben Patchett can talk himself into doing just about anything in the name of fackin' protecting his people. But I can't see him calling a cremation crew on Harold. Too many ways that could have gone south. What if Harold squawked about Camp Wyndham before Ben had a chance to nail him? What if the cremation crew was heavily armed and put up a fight? Nope. I can see Carol doing it. She's a hysteric. She don't think through the consequences of her actions. But Ben has a careful mind. He's half cop, half bean counter."
Maybe Carol called the cremation crew first and only told Ben her plan after. Then he was stuck trying to clean up her mess.
Don nodded glumly.
"You still don't like it?"
"Not by half," Don said.
"Why not?"
"Because she don't have the fackin' cell phones," Don said. "Ben does. How was she gonna call anyone? How would she even know who to call?"
Don took a last heave at the oars and drove the rowboat up into the muck. He hopped out and steadied her as she came to her feet.
"God, you got big all of a sudden," he said.
"I like it," she said.
"I look silly, I can't run, and I can't wear anything except sweatpants and extra, extra large hoodies. But I like the idea of being so big I can easily trample over lesser beings. I don't want to fight my enemies. I want to squash them beneath my tremendous girth."
Don squinted back in toward shore, but it was too dark for either of them to see what Chuck Cargill was up to. Then he glanced past the shed, up to the top of the ridge.
"This camp is about to turn into a fackin' madhouse. I don't think I'll be missed for a few hours. I want to look over the boat while I'm out here, see how sea-ready she is. Maybe I'll even put her in the drink."
He cast another glance down at her belly.
"If I had my druthers, we'd be on the water by tomorrow afternoon. That baby isn't going to wait, and we might need a week or two to get up the coast."
"Go examine the boat. I can paddle back with Mr. Rookwood." Don walked her to the door of the shed, hand on her elbow, as if she were a recovering invalid. The fireman answered the knock wearing polka-dot pajama bottoms and his black and yellow rubber fireman's coat over a grimy undershirt. He was starved, sweaty, needed a shave and a haircut, and he smelled like a campfire.
Harper fought the urge to burrow her face into his chest.
"Lazarus done rose from his fackin' tomb," Don said.
He was almost quivering with pleasure.